I'm Arnav.
And I'm Ansh.
And you're listening to Kathakar, a podcast in which we discuss important turning points and events in history, their human aspects, and the methods we use to study them. The Earth's population has increased rapidly and at faster and faster rates. With increased populations, we have seen accelerated urbanization, with larger clusters of people forming in optimal geographies. Since early human civilization, people have formed clusters of many kinds, including nomadic tribes and small city-states. However, over centuries of development during the medieval, early modern, and industrial ages, the conception of a collective settlement, or city, has evolved. So, the question arises, how can we use mathematics and statistics to understand the growth of modern cities?
Cities continue to evolve and expand over time. And today's guest measures development and growth by using innovation and wealth creation, as well as quantitative methodologies, to describe urban organization and sustainable development. Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey West, a theoretical physicist as well as Shannon Distinguished Professor and former president of the Santa Fe Institute, a fellow of the American Physical Society, and named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World in 2006. Dr. West has dramatically influenced the study of urban development with detailed research and model development of city structure, complexity, and evolution.
So, with all that being said, let's get started. So thank you, Dr. West, for joining us today for this discussion on the development of cities. Today we'll be discussing, you know, over time how cities have grown and evolved and how this can be characterized. But to get an understanding of the growth of cities, we must go back in time to the origins of civilization. So I guess we can start with the basic question, why do people begin clustering and why did this start happening around 8,000 BCE? Why did people begin forming groups and living together in close proximity?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that's an excellent question, and one that has caught people's attention almost since then, probably. I'm not an expert in this, but in terms of what I know, you know, Aristotle, for example, spent quite a bit of time thinking about cities and what they are and what some of their features are, likening them to an organism and so on. So it goes back to very early documentation. I think both the Indian and Chinese ancient literatures also discuss cities and how to plan cities and so on. So, but I would say that the question is intimately related to how did language arise? Because until language came along, you know, we were hunter-gatherers primarily in various forms, and small bands of people roaming various parts of the globe. Somehow during that long period, we evolved language. And that, of course, was the big game changer, because then we could communicate to each other, even if it was maybe in a much more primitive form. And I think what that led to was much more the sense of cooperation. Obviously, hunter-gatherer groups were highly cooperative, but very stable in a certain sense, evolving organically like organisms do, or other social animals. But the discovery of language meant that we could have sort of instant communication and discover, one of the obvious things was discover what you could call economy of scale, that by talking among ourselves, talking to each other, we could accomplish more together than the three of us, for example, individually. And that discovery happened, once it happened, it sort of took on its own momentum. And I think that also led to another major phenomenon related to this, the discovery of agriculture. That is that, again, no doubt related to language, being able to communicate, that you didn't have to just go hunt and gather, so to speak. You could, in some sense, control the gathering by planting seeds, recognizing that you could have dedicated places to grow your food. And then, of course, along came the domestication of animals and so forth. But none of that could be accomplished really without this sense of the collective. So there was a transition at some stage with the discovery of agriculture. Once you had agriculture and the idea that you could grow your food, you didn't have to keep moving. And one of the other things that was discovered in the meantime was storage, being able to store food. But then you have the invention, so to speak, of agriculture. And that allowed us to go from a mobile kind of collective to what's called a sedentary collective, that is staying in the same place. And that is really, I think, the beginning of what eventually became cities, you built it around the food supply, the growing of vegetables and fruits and so forth. And as I say, accomplished also with the domestication of animals to help you with the labor. And very quickly, that led to the permanent settlements. And permanent settlements, as you know, started very early on, of the order of 10,000 years ago, maybe, primarily in the Middle East. But once that started, it took on a very fast momentum. So in a short period of time, relatively speaking, relative meaning we'd been hunter-gatherers for, 100 to 200,000 years or more, maybe, who knows. But in a very short period of time, we formed these communities. We built buildings, learning to build buildings and so forth. From that, we've had sort of this continuous expansion of community and of building, construction, and so forth. And in a certain sense, the structure of those early settlements already contain many of the features that a modern city has. So the concept that we call city, even though these were tiny little villages, of course, was already sort of was evolved in human consciousness in that sort of 8,000, 10,000 years ago. So that's the early beginnings anyway.
So I actually find it interesting how you connected that with language, though, at the beginning, because, sure. I mean, I believe that in our readings, and especially in our classes, we've learned that the idea of storage of the fruits of labor from agriculture came from the ability to write. And, and writing must have developed from the creation of language, I believe. Sure. So the development of writing probably allowed them to store. And then when you can store, then you can participate in commerce. And I believe once you participate in commerce, you realize that living in proximity is best for efficient commerce. So I think that also leads to that agglomeration as well. And of course, what we see today too. So I find that very interesting. Language is not the first thing that my mind jumped to. So
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I used the word language, but in fact, I meant implied in that was also writing. Of course, they didn't develop at the same time. Obviously, writing came much later. But writing was ultimately crucial in further development for precisely the reasons you say, because it allowed for codification, it allowed for recording things. It meant that you could start, you didn't have to any longer just rely on human memory and transmission orally, that you had now documentation and so on. And it is in that sense that those early communities, because of that, really are a sort of an incipient version of what we do today. And it's always interesting, if you look at ancient documents, the only ones I'm familiar with, for Egyptian ones, and you see, or even some of the ancient Greek ones I've seen, it's sort of amazing when you see, a kind of bill of sale or something. I mean, something very mundane, written in hieroglyphics, kind of thing, and it's sort of wonderful in a way to think that you know, we're in that sense the same, you know, where you feel that connection with those very people that started this marvelous journey, which started to, and here's the really important point, of course, at least the part I'm really interested in, the separation of us as a species from everything else, and the development of modern consciousness and what that means. And again, all bound up with language and implicitly writing. It's quite fascinating.
All right. So as, I guess, humanity started evolving through times, more and more technology started developing to the point where we're now in the modern era, and cities have become fully like developed and flushed out compared to, well, let's say the Dark Ages or other periods in history. So what would you say have changed primarily in like the city structure or other structures in the cities from, suppose, the time period that you guys were discussing to, say, the 1950s or anything in the modern era, really?
Yeah. Well, of course, first of all, just to go back to what I said, in many ways, the fundamental elements of what a city is are already there in a very primitive way, maybe. And so in one sense, what has happened is a fantastic elaboration of the basic themes of people living together. Construction of houses, how you build them, the sense of being in close proximity to each other, form special places of either residency for leadership, for parliaments kind of things, or legal affairs to be developed. And by the way, just going back to what we said before, the invention of writing following from language did allow a crucial thing that is important for citizens, and that is governance, laws, for citizens to obey, and that we all agree with to varying degrees and so forth. So all of that, in a way, the modern city is an amplification of all those things. And one of the best examples maybe is that of transportation, because obviously when cities evolve, at the very beginning, villages and small communities grew almost literally organically. And so you have the phenomenon that, for example, European towns still reflect that aspect, because the roads and the lanes and things all go, you know, in some sort of what seemingly arbitrary direction that were formed by the sort of organic growth. Whereas the idea of a planned city, and that's a new phenomenon, relatively, on one hand, which United States cities are overwhelmingly the prime example. That is, you sort of rationalize the system by saying, okay, instead of having roads going in arbitrary directions of arbitrary width and so on, we again structure them to be a grid. They have to be certain widths and so on. So you start to codify the whole system. Now, I said that's a modern one, but of course, you know, Xi'an, which was the old capital of China, if I knew my history better, I could tell you, but probably 5,000 years ago when it was founded, it was laid as a grid. It was a planned city. And there are such cities, and I think some of the early South American cities are planned in that way. So it was already there, but they were very much the exception. The whole point of that is that when we think of the city in terms of its infrastructure, we think of it in terms of its buildings and roads and resource supply systems. And of course, until we had, and that's a new thing, until we had the gas and electricity, all the conduits, all the kind of the vascular system of a city was to do purely with transportation, whether it was for individuals or for the transportation of goods and resources. And then you add to that the gas, electricity, telephones, and so on. And all of those follow the roads, mostly. So the mobility system was sort of fundamental and has formed, if you like, sort of the image of the city, the roads. And by the way, that's been amplified greatly by the invention of the automobile, so much so that we live in America, many American cities, especially out in the West, Los Angeles, again, the prime example, a city that is built for the automobile, basically, rather than what cities were originally for, and many still are in especially in developing countries, but in Europe, are for people to walk, or maybe bicycle in Montenegro. But the point is that the transportation system, being able to get from A to B, was crucial. And it people noticed quite a long time ago that you can sort of maximize the size of a city by how far you can go in 1 hour. Sometimes people say half hour to go there and back. So there's some hand waving in this. And, if you look at old cities, especially those that are very well defined, that's a new phenomenon, that's an old phenomenon. Then you put a wall around the city to protect it. That's something that lasted well through the Middle Ages and eventually disappeared. And all we see are ruins of those. But that wall defined the city explicitly. That meant that you could cross the city. The size of that city was rougher when you optimized it, was roughly being able to walk across it in 1 hour, which is, a few miles, maybe 3 miles, and that's about it. And people did a little survey of, many of the ancient cities, and it's roughly correct. And then it changed with more use of horses, more use of carriages. It started to expand more, and then it expanded, of course, dramatically with the automobile and the train, the steam engine, and so on. And even today, when we think of modern cities and the spreading, this now the city changing from being relatively well-defined in terms of its boundaries, now many cities, and the United States again being, I was going to say the worst example, but the prime example of cities that don't really have a well-defined boundary, physical boundary, they sort of, peter out into the suburbs and all kinds of other stuff. And that was allowed because of the automobile and, of course, the invention of trains. And the size of those cities then could expand tremendously. And typically, until very recently, almost all urban areas, as distinct from city, sort of a generalization of the idea of city, an urban area, is an urban area, by the way, meaning that it's really connected, that it's sort of an economic unit, socioeconomic unit, is again defined by being able to commute to work and back within an hour. So again, that's why some people say, well, people are willing to tolerate, certainly people are willing to tolerate a half hour's commute, but people then for much of the past 50 years or maybe more have been willing to commute an hour to work. I mean, for example, my father, I remember, used to commute 45 minutes. And my sisters, I mean, when they started to work, I grew up in England, in London. So they commuted 40, and they commuted an hour to work. And that was on, the underground, the subway. But that's changing, as I'm sure you well know, that with the enormous kind of socioeconomic pressures that have built up, people are now willing to commute even further. And that's something new that has developed only towards the end of the 20th century, willing to spend an hour and a half or 2 hours. I've always been surprised, just anecdotally, especially in the Bay Area, if I go back to the Bay Area, talking to, say, a taxi driver or an Uber driver, and going from San Francisco airport to downtown, which is about 25 minutes in reasonable traffic, and you find out, well, you know, I used to live in the city or near the city. I now live over in, I don't know, Fresno or somewhere, which is, you know, a 2 hour commute away. And you think, my God, this is extraordinary. And so that's a new development. So, but all of these are elaborations and variations on themes that were set, you know, sort of 5,000 years ago, which is sort of amazing. Of course, they didn't really develop till we had the first great modern cities, versions of those like Rome and maybe the Mayan cities, Xi'an and China, you know, Chinese cities, Indian cities, which I know much less about, but some of the great civilizations have always had major cities, and they all sort of, I mean, one of the amazing things about a city, by the way, is that, you know, when Cortez discovered, invaded, I don't know, Mexico, he recognized immediately a city. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, he came across something that was totally bizarre, like he's on Mars, which to all intents and purposes, he was. He recognized immediately that he came to a city. And, you know, and I think that's true completely across the globe. It's remarkable. In fact, it's sort of amazing when you think about it, that it's sort of like human beings. We're surprised, you know, despite all the ethnicity questions, and we're so extraordinarily narrow in our diversity as individuals. I mean, we all look pretty much the same, and we all have different color skins, okay, and different curly hair and so on, okay, but we're amazingly alike. And so are cities amazingly alike that have been developed. And I think that's kind of really interesting, actually, is the lack of variation, actually. I mean, there is great variation, you know, we see great variation, but actually if you look from 100,000 feet, everything is not so different across the globe. Anyway, that's my long answer to your really interesting question.
Oh, that was very good, actually, because that gave us a lot of insight into, you know, how cities switched from, you know, an organic growth to urban planning, and then how this, yes, and then how, you know, this structure of a city is seen all across the world. And it's a very common phenomenon that, you know, a city will follow a certain structure, and, you know, people will live together in a certain way. And it's, yes, very common throughout the world. So it's very insightful that, you know, humans behave like this, and it's interesting. Yep. But that leads me, though, to wonder, and I'm thinking from a little bit of a mathematical perspective now. So I think you mentioned that, you know, cities at the onset of civilization, cities began to develop in an organic fashion. You know, they would just spread out just as people began settling in the city. But with the onset of city planning, urban planning, and, you know, the development of transportation networks, I assume that the growth of cities or the characteristics of the growth must have changed. So that's why, actually, I don't know if it did change or not. I'm asking the question, did the growth or the pattern of growth of cities change due to urban planning?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I honestly don't know the answer to that. And the reason I don't know the answer to that is because, so I've studied cities in great detail, meaning I've studied them in their present configuration, you know, what they look like in the 21st century, or maybe in 20th century, because I have spent some of my time in the last 20 years trying to develop with colleagues a kind of science, or maybe a physics even, of cities. You know, what is that? Can you really understand the dynamics and structure, organization, evolution, growth of cities in terms of all the various metrics that you can measure about them, whether they're human-centered, socioeconomically centered, or materialistic. And that's given us a lot of insight, I think, to some of these questions. But the reason I can't answer your question about whether there's been a change with the coming of explicit urban planning is because we don't have data. If you're trying to develop a science, especially from, I'm a physicist by training, and well, I am a physicist, and so having data and putting things in quantitative framework and mathematical framework is the way I think about science. And so when we don't have that, it's hard to speculate. But certainly the biggest change, obviously I've already mentioned it, the biggest change in terms of urban planning is the structuring of streets to begin with. As I said, you're all the way back to Xi'an in China. It was already part of people's thinking a long, long time ago. And suddenly the growth of all the new cities in the United States are all urban planned. I mean, New York, as you no doubt know, was laid out in a grid well before they built New York. I mean, they just laid the damn thing out on Manhattan and just filled in the space, so to speak. So you would think that that would have a profound effect because it's no longer quite organic. The other thing that has changed, of course, is that learning how to build up. Now, we did know how to build up because across the globe, we built huge edifices that are almost all related to religion in one form or another. They're all churches or temples. Those are the big edifices and the occasional palace of the leader. So we had, you know, people understood how to build big things, but, you know, I don't know what it would cost. It would be a very interesting exercise to ask, if you wanted to build, I don't know, Notre Dame now, how much would that cost? Could anyone afford it? Could Jeff Bezos, if he wanted to build in Seattle, a marvelous Gothic cathedral of that size with that kind of art and so forth, I wonder what that would cost. I don't know. But anyway, the point is, it was enormously expensive even then, and it took 100 years to build. So you can't do that for everybody. So it had to wait till much, much later, really into the 20th century, I guess, and to be able to build up. And that has changed things, especially as we move into the late 20th century, 21st century. A great city in many ways is defined by tall buildings. I said earlier, I grew up in London. There weren't any tall buildings. The only tall building in London was St. Paul's Cathedral, which is completely dwarfed now by these horrible, humongous skyscrapers, because they are now our religious emblems, of course, overtaking churches and so forth. You would think that would change things. So here's what's amazing is that in terms of the mathematical analysis that we have done, it doesn't seem to, in the sense that even though we don't have data from back then, you know, from 200 years ago, we do have data across cities that are absolute manifestations of all these great, marvelous technological techniques of building, construction, and concept of what a city should be, New York being a marvelous example. But we have the relationship of New York to where I live, Santa Fe, Now, Santa Fe is a very small town. It's the oldest, it's the oldest capital in the United States. It was founded, I think, in 1610. So it's it goes back before, Europeans were here, before they came to Philadelphia and Boston. This was the first part of what's now called the United States that people from Europe started to settle in. And it was a small town then, and it's still a small town, and it's all built of adobe, and it's quite different. It looks completely different than Philadelphia, where you guys are, so you're near Philadelphia. And so you would think that would have huge effect, but in fact, the work that we have done is looking how cities scale relative to each other. That is, you look at all the various metrics of things that you can measure about a city, everything from the length of all the roads, the length of electrical lines, the area of the buildings, the number of patents it produces in a year, the number of crimes it has, the number of schools, anything that you could measure. And you see how that scales against the size of the city. And for size of the city, we usually take as a proxy just the number of citizens, the population. So if you plot that, one of the amazing things that you discover is that all the cities across, say, the United States lie on, roughly speaking, on a straight line, on a single line. They all follow one curve. And that curve happens to be extraordinarily simple mathematically, so that I don't know how sophisticated the audience is to this, but if you plot them logarithmically, and logarithmically simply means you got by factors of 10, and there's good reason to do that, because to get New York and Santa Fe on the same graph linearly, if you plotted 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, all the way up to 15 million, you need a graph paper that's probably bigger than a football field. So the way around that is to plot it as, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, 10 million. So you can put it all, on a piece of paper. And when you plot it that way, and you plot any of these metrics that I just mentioned, they all follow a straight line plotted that way. And now, every city deviates a little bit from those lines. But on the average, everybody lies on a line, which suggests that despite greater urban planning, greater control, greater intervention, different histories, different geographies, even different cultures, that New York is, very roughly speaking, a scaled up Santa Fe. And that's kind of amazing. It's not scaled up in a simple way. It's scaled up in a nonlinear fashion, according to what that straight line is telling you. That of itself is extremely interesting. So it goes back to what I said earlier, that in fact, it's an indication that the same dynamic is at work across all cities. That is, there's this concept called city. It has certain elements to it, and a certain kind of body plan, and there are variations on those. Those variations are not enormous, actually, on the overall scale. So that if you look, from, again, 100,000 feet, they're just scaled versions in a calculable, predictable way. And what is amazing, that same scaling, the way, say, it scales from Santa Fe to New York, gets repeated if you go to Brazil, or you go to Italy, or wherever. It's the same law, and it's the same for all these metrics. It's almost like, it's almost like that, in 1780, when the Industrial Revolution was just beginning, the nations of the world that were involved in it said, gee whiz, you know, the Industrial Revolution is upon us. We've discovered coal. We've invented capitalism, entrepreneurship. We know how to exploit natural resources. We're going to have open markets and so on. All this is going to mean that we're going to build big cities. So we better have an international convention. We better all come together and decide this is how we're going to build our urban systems. And we're going to follow these laws. But of course, that didn't happen. It all happened in a certain, naturally. It all happened, I'll use the word organically again, because in fact, it does follow many of the ways in which, you know, animals evolve from one another and are scaled versions of one another. So the same way that New York is a scaled up version of, I know, Los Angeles, which is a scaled up Chicago, which is a scaled up Philadelphia, whatever, which is a scaled up Boise, and then a scaled up Santa Fe. So it is that in a similar, regular, systematic way, a whale is a scaled up elephant, which is a scaled up giraffe, which is a scaled up human being, which is a scaled up mouse. Even though they look quite different, they have different evolutionary histories. And each piece of them, each organ, each cell type, each genome has different evolutionary histories. Yet we're scaled versions of one another because we follow the same kind of fundamental laws. And that's the kind of work I was involved in, by the way. The work was trying to reveal what those laws are, both in biology and in terms of cities. But they mimic each other. Cities are much more than an organism. But the, in terms of the mathematics and the conceptual framework, they're quite similar, that that each entity is a scaled version in a sophisticated nonlinear fashion, but a way that we can write down the mathematical equations of each other. So therefore, going back to your question, yes, urban planning obviously has had an effect, because you go to New York, it looks very different than Boston, for example. I mean, which is is based on a European idea of just evolving the city originally. Certainly is very different than London or Venice, you know. but nevertheless, you know, these things are intimately related to one another. So therefore, the effects of urban, sort of summarize it, despite all the urban planning, despite all the political intervention and all the practitioners and the architects and so on, nevertheless, these have had a secondary effect. And you can actually quantify it. I would say at about the 80 to 90% level, these cities are scaled versions of one another. And the answer to your question is yes, there was this, the effect of urban planning, et cetera, is sort of a 10 to 20% effect, maybe. I'm sort of hand waving a bit there, but that's to give you a sense of scale. Sorry, that was, again, a long answer to a really important question, actually.
No, that was very interesting too. In fact, actually, that was leading me, first of all, I'd like to say, I like how you made the connection between animal systems and city systems, because, you know, a city can be treated as a living, breathing system that, you know, takes inputs and outputs, you know, just like animals and their internal processes mm-hmm. do as well. So they're very similar in that way. And the thing that I actually wanted to ask about was, this is just about, you know, the scaling from Santa Fe to New York City. So if I were to take New York City at the time when it had the same population as Santa Fe does today, yeah. then would New York City in the past scale in the same way to New York City present as Santa Fe today scales to New York City today?
That's a very good question. And the answer is probably not, actually. And that's a very, you know, so in other words, to rephrase what you said, what I would have been talking about is the scaling between different cities, or the scaling between different organisms. And the question is the time evolution and growth of a city follow that same trajectory as between cities? I guess in biology, that is, you know, does phylogeny follow ontogeny? You know what I mean? That is, does, you know, as you grew, you could ask the same question from a baby up to an adult. When you were the size of a dog, were you like a dog? I mean, it's a similar kind of question, because you do scale relative, you as an adult, relative to an adult. Well, dog is a bad example because dogs did not evolve by natural selection. So maybe you relative to a rat. where you weren't the size of a rat, this is terrible, and I gotta think of something better. Size of a sheep, there you go, the sheep is domesticated too. But anyway, you get the idea. So, and in fact, in biology, it's in terms of these scaling laws, there's an approximate similarity, in fact, but there's much more variance, much more outliers to that kind of scaling. In cities, because of the huge externalities that are happening, you know, the major innovations and inventions and so forth that take place over short periods of time, which does not happen in biology, that is, you know, you could imagine going back, I'm out of my depth here a little bit, 100,000 years, and looking at a human being. And of course, at first you'd say, I don't look anything like that. You know, some primitive, before you make some terrible remark about such a person. But in fact, if you took that person and cut their hair and their beard and dressed them in the same clothes that you're wearing, you probably wouldn't be able to tell any difference. They'd still be a person like you. It's always wonderful, you know, when they discover these things preserved in bogs or places, you know, of some human being. That's only usually 10,000 or so years ago, maybe a little longer. They look just like us. I mean, they may be dressed differently and they usually have beards like I do, but they are us. And that's because we haven't evolved. We barely evolved. I mean, we haven't evolved. We're the same thing as we were. That is not true, probably, of cities, because huge innovations and evolutionary paradigm shifts have taken place between, I don't know, 1800 and, 2020. So I think the answer to your question is that if you actually had the data, you would see significant variation. If there hadn't been any evolution of cities in terms of tech, if everybody still walked, but somehow you were able to have a coherent city that was 10 miles across, which of course you couldn't, I think, but if you could, we hadn't started to use horses in cities, and we hadn't started to use bicycles and automobiles and trains, just as one example, and hadn't grown tall buildings and so on, then maybe the sort of what we would call intraspecies, that is within a single species, scaling would have been the same as the interspecies, between species, as it is approximately with biology. So there's a big difference. And that difference is all to do with a fundamental difference between a city and an organism. And that is what we're doing now and what started the whole process. That is, we can talk to one another and we're continually inventing and evolving, creating ideas, innovating, creating more wealth, trying to increase standards of quality of life, and so on. We're doing that not only all the time, we're doing it at an extraordinary rate. And that all comes from that same discovery of language and later writing. And that separated us from biology and allowed us to make what would be considered major innovations in body plans for animals or plants that would have taken at a minimum hundreds of thousands of years, possibly to millions of years. We could do those in my lifetime, your lifetime. I mean, gee whiz, in my lifetime, when I think of the changes, I mean, this would be beyond science fiction, what we're doing. So that changes. So that's sort of the answer. The answer is no, because of that. And it's an essential feature of what cities are about, and distinguishes them fundamentally from organisms. So there is a part of the city which is like an organism, but that's mostly its infrastructure, its buildings, roads, and transportation, blah, blah, blah. But the essence of a city, which is the whole point of a city, is to facilitate social interaction. And so social interaction is the real center of what a city is, communication. That is something that exists only in a very minor form among even social organisms.
So I would like to thank you for that insight on what Arnab had said about the different scales, how cities develop and how the scales would differ because of the system the cities are grown in. So I would like to further stem that question and ask, what are some of the different things that would change a city? I.e., I'm trying to hint at, like, what would suppose like population growth or like increased patent pending, like patent development or innovation in different cities do to a city compared to suppose like New York City. So for example, like if Santa Fe, one day all of the world's brightest scientists came to Santa Fe, what would that do to a city? Or like if Santa Fe grew by like 10 million population, what would that do to the city? And I just wanted to figure that out.
Well, of course, we've seen that in various cities at various times. You know, one of the first modern examples is Manchester in England, because it was a small town of, 20,000-30,000 people in probably, I'm guessing now, 1780, 1800. And along came the Industrial Revolution, and Manchester became a center of that because it was near the mining of coal and mining of iron to make steel, and most importantly, the whole cotton industry and the use of, the invention of machines to process cotton and to make garments and so forth. And so that grew at an enormous rate. And Manchester, in a way, is what happened to certain cities in Asia with the exploitation of workers, of people who were mostly at that time rural agricultural workers, bringing them into the city to get jobs at a relatively cheap rate in order to produce goods, cheap and affordable goods for the growing middle classes and expanding upper classes. And that started, that phenomenon was, in the modern essence of it, started in Manchester. And we've just seen it repeated across the globe in various forms. There it was just exploitation of poor agricultural people. And the interesting thing about that is that it had to come along with the same thing that came out of the Industrial Revolution, and that is the huge technological advances in agriculture, because that had to go along with it, because as you improve the technology of agricultural production, you needed less workers. And so they were displaced and had to go to the city, in this case, Manchester, to work in these horrible cotton mills and go down the mines and all the rest of that stuff, the dark history, so to speak, of the Industrial Revolution. But that is an example where something happened, something, you know, that has played an enormous role in terms of the planet. The Industrial Revolution, of course, which started a lot of all this, and Manchester went from some small, sleepy town into a major city, a major industrial city of, I don't know what population, probably approaching a million people, even back, I don't know when, I don't know my numbers for that, but into a major city. And then we've seen it repeated in various other places. And the modern example, of course, which is a slightly different version, of course, Silicon Valley and San Jose, San Francisco, in a slightly different form. That's an unusual one because it's happened in a kind of suburban setting. And that's, of course, largely due to the nature of the high-tech industry. And also because it's sort of interesting, again, you know, to make this computer, if Silicon Valley had to not just produce the ideas and the software and all the other gadgetry, but had to actually make the hardware, it would have turned into a Manchester kind of image rather than a sort of Palo Alto Mountain View image. And it took all the hard industrial polluting kinds of stuff, it shipped overseas to exploit again. And so it's sort of an interesting example of something that, of a similar phenomenon in answer to your question. A new technology came along, which focused on an individual place. And it's happened in other places, you know, I mean, it's just as the, Detroit and the automobile is another example. And it's sort of interesting that these things don't get spread around. That's a very interesting phenomenon of itself. It's still, despite even Elon Musk in deciding he wants to live in crappy old Austin rather than in San Francisco, I think Silicon Valley will survive and still be, you know, it hasn't spread. There are, of course, internet companies and high-tech companies across the globe, but the center still remains Silicon Valley. And as it did for Detroit, you know, automobiles were made all over the globe, and they were made even in somewhat different parts of the United States to a small degree, but that remained the center. Now, things do change, and Detroit is a marvelous example where it was unable to adapt to external changes. And that probably will happen with Silicon Valley. And maybe Elon Musk moving out in this whole, and this mini exodus from San Francisco is a signal of that. I don't know. But there is this phenomenon that that you're pointing to, that a city has a profound effect upon a city, but the city, I think another way, I would turn it around, to be honest, and maybe I should have said this at the beginning, that city facilitated that happening. It's not that it happened to the city was the machine that made it happen. It's not an accident that high tech developed in Silicon Valley. That's why, you know, if suburban Philadelphia decided, you know, the leaders of the Philadelphia urban area said, gee whiz, we're going to rival Silicon Valley, we're going to do it. It's enormously difficult. I mean, you have to have very special conditions and so on. I mean, Mayor Bloomberg wanted to do that with New York, and there are lots of high tech in New York and so on. But, you know, the center remains in California. Now, that does change. I'm not arguing, obviously, that these things don't change. And as I said, Detroit is a good example of a city that has suffered because it's not able to adapt. And that's the crucial thing to the externalities. Things are continually evolving and changing, and all these systems are doing that. And if you don't respond and you cannot adapt, you will die. And cities do die because of, can die because of that. Or at least die is the wrong word. They get eclipsed. And you live in a part of the country, well, Pennsylvania, of course, has seen that as being, it's a bit like Manchester. It was the American version following Manchester of the Industrial Revolution. It was even more powerful and influential, of course, the steel mills. And so when I first came to this country, steel was dominant. You know, I mean, if the steel workers threatened to go on strike, that was a national emergency. It was phenomenal. And this is not, I'm talking about 1961, 62. Now, if the steel workers threatened to go on strike, very few people, I mean, I'm sure people in Lehigh Valley and so on care deeply if that's in such places, but the rest of the country doesn't care, which is sad, by the way, but that's just the change that takes place. So you need to adapt to that. So again, a long answer to a very good question.
So I was actually going to next ask about the different quantities and the different measurements and measures that are used in the analysis of city growth. So I think specifically, we actually looked at one of your works and we saw that things such as, I think as Ansh mentioned before, things such as patent approval and innovation and things like these were quantified. And we saw that in your work, you noted how things relating to the to economies of scale, such as, you know, cable, laying cable and things like that, were seen to have sublinear growth in cities, whereas things such as innovation and wealth creation due to social interaction were coming in cities were seen to have a superlinear growth. So why does this happen? And also, if you would if you would like to, then would you be able to explain superlinear and sublinear growth to our audience? That'd be
great. Yes, that's we could spend the next hour doing that, but I'll try to do it in a few minutes. So you know, I talked about the scaling of animals. Let's just talk about mammals, just us, so to speak. So if you ask about how does our most fundamental metric about us scale, namely our metabolic rate, how much food do you need each day just to stay alive? The 2,000 food calories on your Kellogg's cornflakes box, so to speak. By the way, just a side comment, people don't realize that 2,000 food calories a day in terms of energy use is exactly equivalent to about 100 watts, 100, a light bulb. That's all you need. All that food you eat a day to stay alive is an old incandescent light bulb, which is an amazing statement about the extraordinary efficiency of biological processes and the extraordinary inefficiency of man-made technology. And maybe I'll come back to that in a minute. But the point is that you ask, how does that scale from the smallest mammal, which is the shrew, up to the biggest, the blue whale? And as I said, that scales in a very regular way. And you can derive that by looking at the way in which energy is distributed in your body, which is through your various networks, like your circulatory system, supplying blood to your cells, and so on. So there's a whole mathematical theory for that. And to put it in simple terms, what you discover is that if you double the size of any organism, let's just keep mammals again, it's true for all organisms, but for mammals, if you double the size of a mammal, look at a mammal that's twice the size of another, so it has twice as many cells, instead of what you might think you need twice as much food to support twice as many cells, in fact, you only need about 75%, about three quarters as much. So, and that doesn't matter whether you go from 10 grams to 20 grams, or 100 grams to 200, or from 100 kilograms to 200 kilograms. Doesn't matter, just double anywhere. You have the same 25% savings. That comes about because of the mathematics and physics of these networks that control the distribution of energy and resources inside your body. Now, that is called an economy of scale because it means that the bigger you are, the less energy is needed to support a gram of your tissue or one of your cells by this 25%. So your cells are working less hard than your cat or dogs, but it's working harder than your horses in a systematic, predictable way. So what about city? So a city, the analog to those networks in a city are the things we talked about, those transport networks, the electrical lines and so on. They're sort of like your circulatory system and so on. And indeed, they obey similar scaling laws. The only difference is if you look at a city that's twice the size of another, then instead of needing twice the length of the roads or twice the number of gas stations, it only needs, it's not quite like biology, it needs 85%. So with this doubling, there's a 15% rather than 25% savings for a city. And that's so cities are very much like an organism in their infrastructure because it turns out that the bigger you are with each doubling, you only need 85% as much. So Philadelphia is much more efficient than Scranton, as an example. And that's great. So if you just go by pure efficiency, the bigger the city, the better, just on pure mechanical efficiency. Now, as I've sort of intimated earlier, that's sort of the less interesting part of a city, even though that's the part you think of, the infrastructure, the buildings and roads. Because all of that is there in order to facilitate social interaction. And so the most interesting part of a city is social interaction, then your social networks that are the city, the various social networks. Now, they have a very different kind of dynamic because they're doing what we're doing, except this is a special setup. That is, there's three of us. I'm talking to Ansh. Ansh is sort of talking to Arnab. Arnab talks back to me, and we sort of go on in this way, and we build on each other. Here we're sort of formalized, but, you know, in a casual situation, in a coffee bar, or, you know, in your dorm rooms, if you were students or whatever, you build on each other, you build on ideas, you create ideas all the time. You're continually creating ideas by this mechanism. All of those ideas are of almost no interest to anybody else, and then most of them go nowhere. But that's what a city does, is bring people together to do that. And what is amazing is the spirit of what goes on in that social network is positive feedback, continuous positive feedback. And every once in a while, it produces the theory of quantum mechanics, where it produces an Amazon or a Google or General Motors. That's what the city has done. It's brought people to do this, to churn it and interact. So that leads to the idea that the more people you have, because you're always increasing social connectivity and therefore more positive feedback, instead of getting less per capita, as you do for organisms and for the infrastructure, needing less per capita of infrastructure, in social phenomena, socioeconomic phenomena, which are all derived from social interactions, you get more per capita the bigger you are. That's called superlinear scaling. The economy of scale, less per capita, is called sublinear scaling. And cities, so organisms overwhelmingly function, if you look across the whole biosphere, they're all dominated by these scaling laws. They all function by economies of scale and sublinear scaling. The bigger you are, the less per capita, efficiency dominates. But in cities, we have both. Efficiency plays a big role. As I said earlier, you need less roads per capita, less petrol stations, and et cetera, et cetera. But you get this marvelous thing that you get more social interactions, more socioeconomic activity, so that you get more, you get higher wages in a city, you get more wealth, you get more ideas, more patents are produced per capita in a city. But you also get what I call the good, bad, and the ugly. Those are all the good things, but you also get more crime per capita. It's more interactions. You get more disease per capita. So for example, much better to be living in a small town during a pandemic, such as we're going through, than living in a big city, because you get more interactions. And in fact, let me see if I can remember this number that we calculated, that a city of 10 million has twice as many cases per capita in half the time a city of 100,000 does, okay? So you get more cases per capita and they come faster if you're the bigger you are. And so much better to be in a small place if during a pandemic in terms of getting COVID-19. But in terms of everything else, in terms of having more opportunities, it's kind of a more buzzy, sexier life, interacting with more people, more exposed to more culture, exposed to more ideas, and so on, much better to be in a big city. So, and that's superlinear scaling, bigger the better. And just to put some numbers on it, I said earlier for organisms, if you double the size, you only need 75% as much. There's a 25% savings, say, of how much food you need. And that's true, by the way, of anything that you can measure about an organism, whether it's a physiological quantity or some life history event, that is, even things like, how long it takes you to grow, how long you live, how many offspring you have. They're all dominated in a similar way by this one quarter kind of rule. In the city, for the infrastructure, as I said earlier, the rule is the analog to that for the infrastructure is sort of 0.25, it's 0.15. But in terms of the socioeconomic effects, the good, bad, and the ugly things I talked about, the enhancement that you get is about 15%. So you get 15% more than every time you double, you get 15% more sort of value added in terms of ideas, patents, and so forth, but 15% more chance of getting AIDS or flu or COVID. So that's sort of the difference between them, and that's what makes cities so fantastic and also leads to cities having sort of open-ended growth, whereas, organisms, because they stop growing, that's why you stop growing, actually, because you don't have this continuous building, and you stop growing, and also leads ultimately to your death, whereas cities sort of just keep growing, basically, is the big picture. I mean, everything I should say, a big caveat I should add, and I sort of said it earlier, this is all what we call coarse-grained. It's very much at a big picture level, because, we have all this data, we plot it, we have these marvelous laws that we can derive mathematically. But the points, each city or each organism lies a little bit off the curve. And because it's that, what I said earlier, it's that, 10, 20% deviation. And it is within that that urban planners or manipulators work in order to make Philadelphia look different than Boston and look different than Los Angeles.
Yeah, I sometimes think, from the perspective of, understanding the effects of the social interactions, the social interactions are what produce the good ideas, and they're what create inventors and create the careers for inventors, and they create the patents. So I often wonder, the way in which you're quantifying innovation and wealth creation is, you know, through these data points and data, or through these measures such as patent production and in a number of inventors and things like that. So I often wonder, can you take historical data and represent and find a way to connect that historical data back to as an indicator for city growth? Like, what I mean is some past historical data, such as something like storage of food, or like the records of the amount of food you have, whether that can be some kind of indicator or some kind of instrument in a statistical experiment that can help you indicate that, you know, because there was this amount of food, the city was growing at this pace, or this is why this city evolved like this at this particular time. So I often wonder whether we can take, like, and I mean like data from, you know, the 1500s or prior to that, because, you know, I know they used to record things like that. So that's what I was just thinking.
As I said earlier, no, that's a very good question, and is the source of enormous frustration for us, because we would love to have data from, you know, 1920, 1820, 1420 of cities across different urban systems and so on. And sadly, that's never been systematic. Well, hardly any of it has been compiled. And the frustration is, and this is speculation, that data actually exists in some form, because people were recording event phenomena, you know, some of it quite crudely, for a very long time, certainly from the Middle Ages in Europe, and I suspect in other parts of the world, people have been recording things. It's hard for me to believe that the Chinese, that were so top down and were so organized and had, you know, an administrative class, didn't have great records of many things. So they probably exist, actually, in various forms, in various volumes, in, you know, leather-bound volumes stuffed in basements somewhere. And, of course, what we need is kind of some international project that goes digging into those basements and digitalizes all of this stuff. You know, and I honestly don't know to what extent that exists and quite what form it is in. But I'm sure it's very rich and can be very rich. So we need a project like that. By the way, just a side comment to say it's not so crazy. The British law courts, or what, I don't know who runs it, the equivalent to the Department of Justice maybe in the United Kingdom, digitalized essentially all court records from about the 15th century, I think it is, including, you know, testimony of witnesses and so on. And so people, including one of my colleagues, has become a major player in this, has started doing these marvelous word analyses of what people did to indicate the way people were feeling about things, what they were doing and so on, using that as a source. So you need something like that for, you know, much drier, may I say, a bit of the statistics. So in answer to what you need. So we don't have that. However, a little bit has been done, and I haven't been involved in it other than very peripherally, by some of my colleagues. One of the best is that there were a couple of young people working with us. One was an anthropologist, and one was one of my major collaborators, Luis Betancourt, who is now at the University of Chicago. Scott Orman is the anthropologist who's now at the University of Colorado. They and some others got together and realized they had exactly the kind of data you're talking about for what could be considered an urban system in pre-Columbian Mexico. And I think it contains about 40 communities. I hesitate to call them cities, but villages, let's call them, but, you know, having characteristics of cities. And archaeologists have pored over this community for many years, and they've measured various things. And, you know, the the obvious thing is just looking at the layout of these towns, if you want to call them, or villages, in terms of the number of buildings, the size of the buildings, and so on. But the other thing is, the richest sources are the trash piles, because one of the the great challenges of living in a collective is, what do you do with all the trash? And communities had to deal with that from the very beginning, and archaeologists and anthropologists make great use of those by digging through them and looking at the number of pot shards and number of grains of this and all the rest of that stuff, which I know almost nothing about. But you have to trust that there is, a formalized methodology that people agree to, that tells you, what are these proxies for, in the same way, by the way, that I was using patents as a proxy for innovation. Otherwise, it's very hard to measure innovation, but patents are some form of a proxy for innovation. So it is with, pot shards and various grains and various sizes of rooms and buildings and so on. Anyway, they put all this together and they looked how it scaled across this urban system, because there are different sizes. Of course, it doesn't vary by a lot. And maybe it varies by an order of magnitude, I don't remember. But what was very satisfying about it was that they saw the same scaling laws that we see across the cities of America today. So that goes back to your question. Maybe I should have answered with that example back then near the beginning of this conversation. That's one of the few examples I know of trying to be very creative about sort of the detritus, the remnants, and of societies, of cities. Now, I should say, I think that work has been quite controversial among archaeologists and anthropologists. I like it very much. I think it's terrific, and it's very creative. I realize it must have a significant speculative component, but it's remarkable that it came up with the same 15% rule, basically. There has also been work, also by some colleagues, on Rome. There's lots of records on. My light. Is that too? I'll turn that off. If it's is that a news? Okay. And that also showed. There were some records. There were serious records that people, historians, have dug up, and this group examined those and convinced themselves that it too was sort of behaving like a modern city in terms of these kinds of phenomena that we're talking about and the kinds of scaling laws. Yes, but it's a shame that we can't do much better than that, that we don't have the same kinds of records that we have today. And by the way, even the records today, I can tell you, most of them, the records on patents, we only could really use in a way that we could justify back to about 1960. So it's, they're big gaps. And it points to something else. Even though people were taking records, if you don't, and that's one of the great things about science, the way science works, is that if you start to have conceptual frameworks and theory that has predictions, it starts to motivate the kinds of data you should be, kinds of observations you should be making, and the kinds of data that you should keep and analyze. And of course, there wasn't anything like that. So people just kept records that they thought might be useful for, future planning. That's basically what motivated everything.
So on that note of future planning, I think I'm going to switch gears a little bit towards you know, the analysis of future growth of cities.
Yeah.
And the question that I have is just based on the acceleration of innovation in cities. So I think in one of your works, you came to the conclusion that, you know, as population growth increases in cities, the cycles of these population of fixed population growth begins to decrease, that time decreases. So as that time decreases, you need to accelerate innovation in order to sustain that population growth. So the question we have is, in the future, you know, in 2030, 2040, 2050, what methods could be used to sustain the population? Like, what methods of accelerating innovation could be used?
No, no, this is the part that I'm most interested in a way, this question of what are the implications for the future and the whole question of how does it play into global sustainability? Because one of the things that comes out of this framework is that, I already said, those superlinear scaling laws, having more socioeconomic activity per capita the bigger you are, has its origins in the positive feedback mechanisms that are inherent in social interactions and in social networks. And so you can understand and explain the growth of cities as well as these scaling laws. But one of the things it leads to is that we can understand why we have open-ended growth. On the other hand, this theory also shows that you can't sustain it. That is, that the only way to sustain it, if you keep everything the same, this goes back to what we talked about earlier, if you don't change anything, you're destined to collapse, turns out, in this. So what it says is that if to avoid collapse, you have to make a major innovation, because what you recognize is the growth has taken place within some given paradigm. You discovered iron, you invented bronze, you know, that's what we call it, the Iron Age, the Bronze Age. It sort of sets the tone, the culture for a certain period. And then we have the Industrial Revolution, the discovery of coal and so forth. And more recently, the invention of computers. And then more recently, the invention of the internet and so on. And what this theory says is that you've had to do that because if you didn't, if you just stayed with in the Stone Age, things would eventually collapse. That's sort of the idea. Because you would have increased population and that couldn't keep up with it. Couldn't keep up with what that Stone Age technology had. So you're on this kind of accelerating treadmill, is sort of the idea. And it's all to do with the increasing pace of life. And in fact, that's part of the theory, that the pace of life increases with size in a systematic way. And just again, anecdotally, certainly when I was your age, life, as I look back, was so much slower, really, than it is today. I'm 80 years old and I can't keep up with anything. You know, I'm just sort of, you go nuts. You clear your inbox in the morning and it's full again. You know, it's sort of like, whereas when I grew up, you begged for a nice letter to come that day, and then, you know, another one 2 days' time, and you'd answer it in a week. You know, that was during my lifetime. You know, it's kind of amazing. So it's gone from that to where someone gets annoyed at me, they send me a message, and I haven't responded in 24 hours. You know, that it sort of drives you nuts. And we're all going nuts, of course, with this. So this is all to do with, so it's kind of a weird, I don't know what it is. I sometimes think of it as poetic justice. The very structure and dynamic mechanism that brought us all this great success, the increasing standards of living and the increased quality of life on the average, you know, we could talk about, and by the way, we've talked a lot about, I'm not going to talk here about inequality in cities and so on, but the overall increase of material well-being, whether that's good or bad, I mean, that's what's happened. The increase in of quality of material life is you can only sustain that if you make a major paradigm shift. And indeed, if you look at the rate at which we've been doing that, it agrees with the predictions of this framework, which you have to do it faster and faster. So another major paradigm shift or innovation, so to speak, has to come along in the next 15, 20 years. Now, it could be something as mundane, though it might be profound, as self-driving cars. I mean, at first you think, well, that just means that transportation is going to be easier, but it will affect every single part of your life, actually. I mean, that's what's amazing. Who would think the invention of the computer, which was to compute, the idea of a computer was to compute, was to help me do my calculations. That's what it was for. That's what all computers were when I was your age. They were there to compute. Who would believe that it ends up me talking to you two guys on a podcast in 2021, and it's got nothing to do with computing. I mean, I hardly use this for computing. I use it for communication and as an extension of my brain. So there's all these unintended consequences, but the other unintended consequences is that I'm going nuts, as many people are. And that going nuts, that feeling of being, left behind, you can't keep up with things and so on. I think this is now total speculation, leads to the kind of bizarre political situation that we're beginning to see, have begun to see develop. The move towards more authoritarian rule, the rejection of science, the rejection of facts, and people don't want to get vaccinated, they don't believe in this, they don't believe in that, the loss of authority. I think it's a large part of reflection of the great anxiety that many of us feel because we're on this bloody treadmill that we've created. And it's so the very mechanism that has led to our success is leading potentially to our demise, as we simply can't keep up. And that's where global warming comes from, or climate change, let's call it. The same kind of thing. It's because of this huge socioeconomic activity. If you burn the surface of a sphere, it gets hot, period. So and we have been burning the surface of this sphere, which we call the Earth, at an incredible rate for the last 200 years. And you don't have to be a physicist or a scientist or have an IQ above 65 to know that if you heat, if you burn, if you put fire on the surface of somewhere, it gets hot. So obviously we got, we're heating some, which therefore we change the climate. Punct. Proof. Period. So that's those are huge issues. This whole dynamic is leading us to what is the next paradigm shift? And there will be one. And as I say, I don't know what it is, and it's impossible to predict. And it might even be, cultural. It could be a social shift. And we see little teeny bits of that, and ultimately we probably will need that. Even the beginnings of things like the Green Movement, or even, you could even argue that the beginnings of seeing that you need a cultural shift is occurring in terms of right-wing politics and left-wing politics. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know if that's to do with it or not. But we do need, there will be shifts. And as I say, it might be cultural. It might just be another technological shift. I mean, one of the problems that we're facing in terms of the idea of paradigm shifts or innovation, the word innovation in the last 20, 30 years has become synonymous with technology. But it needn't be. It needn't be technological. It could be something else. So for example, another minor shift that's happening, throughout from the beginnings of modern capitalism and the sort of modern version of a company, what a company is, and the development of the corporation. The idea of a company is that it acts as a sort of intermediary between production and the customers, so to speak. And it's developed to be much more than that. That's sort of fundamentally what it is. But the motivation being to make profit, and that's the prime, as they should. And that's been a huge success. But one thing that has not been part of the culture of companies and corporations, or at least a very minor part, has of course been social responsibility. Hasn't been the responsibility of companies really from the beginning to make sure that their product is for social good. And what we're beginning to see at the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century is the beginnings of that corporations should not only be there to make profit, but they should be there to facilitate and encourage social good. And of course, we're seeing that being played out with Facebook. And in fact, I was amused in a curious way when this woman, what was her first name? Miss Horgan, the whistleblower for Facebook, talked to Congress. Her most damning comments, the thing that she was most irate about, was that Facebook wasn't being socially responsible. Wasn't that it was, secondarily was that they were covering up things and all the rest. It was that they were not being socially responsible. Now, 50 years ago, if there were investigations of the steel industry or the automobile industry, that would not have been the case. They would have said, they built a car. Well, they did. They built a car that was good, that was going to lead to accidents. The famous Pinto of Ford was a classic example. But they weren't attacked. They weren't. The word social responsibility wasn't really part of the vocabulary. So that's something new, and I don't know if that's a harbinger of serious change or not. But certainly, I interact with some of the companies and some of the major corporations. And I am impressed that, that is part of their consciousness now, how big a role it will play and whether it can play it fast enough, who knows. But it is all related to some of this dynamics that is what a city is about. And a company is another kind of version of that. So I'm sorry, as again, I went sort of off. I allowed myself to speculate. That the last 10 minutes should be seen as speculation. They don't follow directly from the science. Everything I said before, I would stand by in terms of the science. I might be wrong about all the speculations about the future.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. West, for your insight into the development of cities and much more than that as well. Arnab, do you have anything else to say?
Oh, I think it was interesting to hear your speculations, and I think it'll be interesting to see what the next paradigm shift will be. Sure. That will sustain our population growth. So, but thank you much for joining.
By the way, you're an amazing. You will see that. I mean, you will live. I won't. I may see the beginnings of it, possibly, but I doubt it. But you will see. You will go through some other major thing, and it may become unwittingly, like I said, the computer, the laptop. We went from computer to laptop to the internet. Who believed the internet? My God. Berners-Lee had absolutely, I don't care what he says, he had no idea what he was inventing when he did it. He invented it so that a bunch of high-energy physicists like me could easily exchange data and interact with each other. And because they were dealing with humongous amounts of data that needed to be analyzed online. So it was a marvelous invention. But gee whiz, who would believe that that would change the course of human history in a certain sense? I'm not demeaning his role. I mean, it was a phenomenal thing that he did. But I happen to know, because I was visiting CERN, that no one had any idea that it was going to be anything more than a useful tool. So it'll be like that. It'll come up on you, you know, when you're least suspecting it. Someone will invent something. It might just be on the other hand, it could be an electric car, or rather, you know, self-driving. I don't know. Who knows? But it might be something completely different.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Kathakar. Make sure to check out some of our other episodes on our website at kathakar.media. You can also listen to them on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and many more podcast services. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to join us next time.